Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS, and this is the Limoch Technical Net. I'm going strong for 44 years. Every Sunday night, pretty much, at 8 o'clock, we meet in front of our radios, and we chat with each other. We exchange ideas. We teach each other. We learn from each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions. We had one in about the last 4 years. Or if you have technical expertise in some technology that's gotten into the news and you'd like to share it with us, or if you have a TechNet puzzle, they're as rare as hen's teeth, and they're a wonderful resource to kind of tease information and the memories of technical information we learned years ago and might have forgotten. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space or NASA-related story. Of course, you can contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, as I often mention, I cut and paste interesting articles that I've seen throughout the previous week, put it on a link page, and it's available 24/7 any old time. If you've got a case of insomnia and you want to take a look at some articles, at least I found interesting, all you have to do is type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. We keep those links live for as long as possible. We have a chat room available. It's kind of quiet these days, but if you're curious and or interested, just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. We offer a audio stream of the technical net through the Internet. We used to just keep it live for the technical net, but some people asked me to keep it live the rest of the week, so we try and do that. You can reach it by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And I always like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limoch technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. So, you know, avail yourself of the wisdom of people who kind of moved out of the area, or unfortunately some that have become silent keys. Their wisdom persists on the audio file. So keep that in mind. Let me drop for a moment and tell you what we got planned. Okay, standard operating technical net tonight. Not really that much in the AI news, so we'll pass for this week and see if something more interesting comes next week. We have the continuing adventures of FCC docket delete, delete, delete. The ARRL, after thinking real hard for 9 days, came up with a reply. And I'll leave it to one of you guys, if you're very interested and or curious, to bring up the subject during the question segment of the technical net. I don't want to kind of start it now. It, you know, either it'll die very quick or it may continue for hours. And so I want to give people the benefit of the ability to get on the list and start asking questions. And that should take us hopefully to about 10:15. Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report, which should take us approximately to 11 p.m. And I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan if physics works and my shack still operates and the repeater behaves and I don't get thrown off of All-Star too many times. So with all that in mind, we're open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name, your call sign, and whether it's amateur radio related or not, and stuff like that.
W2BZ ham radio comment.
N2XN ham radio related.
K2GJE.
What does the FCC want to delete, delete, delete?
Okay, Rich recognized, Wes recognized, Ed recognized. Ed, do you have enough time to stick around? Because, you know, I have a 50-50 odds that either it'll kind of burn out in 5 minutes or it'll go on for an hour and a half. So I just want to know what kind of time frame you have available as the third person on my little list here tonight.
I usually drop at 10.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. Rich, what do you got for us tonight? I think I know, but I'll ask anyway.
You think I'm going to talk about RF grounding, huh? Well, yeah, that's one thing, RF grounding. They say, I've learned in the last week or so that you can't ground out RF. Problems with RF, like if you're getting RF burns and all that, if you put a stake in the ground, that's not going to take care of it. At least that's my understanding. But what I want to talk about is, about a month ago, I bought a 7300, and late last night, I downloaded the service manual, and I was looking at the service manual, and I get to the parts list. And there's about 200-300 parts on each page, page after page after page after page of parts. And I got this overwhelming feeling that it's a miracle that these radios work. Because the parts are 90% surface mounted. You have, you know, hundreds of resistors and capacitors. You have CPUs and other ICs. And they all have to be soldered perfectly. So I really got this overwhelming sense that it's next to a miracle that they can build a radio like this, or any modern radio, and have it work. Because all it would take is one surface mount solder, not to take, and you got to go in there and with all this test equipment, find out what it is and correct it. But mine worked out of the box, and I'm still flabbergasted at the amount of parts in this radio. And then I started looking at the block diagrams, and I started looking at the board layouts, and boy, are these complicated machines that we take for granted. And I feel blessed that I've spanned so many years of technology that I've made it this far to technology like the 7300 or any of the modern rigs, especially the SDR rigs. They're just beyond belief in terms of engineering. They're otherworldly in terms of engineering. So I just wanted to make that comment. The other comment I wanted to make was, after 60 years in ham radio, I just discovered 30 meters. I've always wanted to get good at CW. And when I took the extra back then, you had to pass 20 words a minute CW to get the extra. Now there's no code requirement at all. But back then, so I got to 20, with a lot of hard work, I got to 20 words a minute, but that was 25 years ago or more. Now I'm probably somewhere between 10 and 13 words a minute. And I just decided to look on 30 meters, which I never did. And I saw that it's either all CW, well, it's all CW or digital. No phone, no 20-meter craziness, no 40-meter craziness. It's just CW and digital.
That's the point.
So the CW signals are so clean, and plus it's between 20 and 40 meters, so you get long distance, and you get, you know, local stuff. There was a guy copying earlier today. Let me let it drop one more time. So I sort of fell in love with 30 meters now, and I just had three CW QSOs. It's CW is hard enough for me, no less when there's QSB on the signal, and you miss whole words because you can't even hear the other guy. You know, I go crazy. It's nerve-wracking, but I know if I keep at it, I'll get good, and I always wanted to have a CW conversation at like 20, 25 words a minute, where both of you would just, you know, turning it back to each other very quickly without going through the calls just by sending a BK, which is back. I always wanted to do that, and I'm working my way towards it. So those are the three comments, the RF comment and ground, and the magic of the radios that we take for granted, and then 30 meters. Go back to Roy.
Okay, very good. I'm glad you're enjoying yourself. That's the point of the exercise. If you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. I don't know. My attitude is, you know, I mean, again, whatever floats one's boat. You can do a lot of CW on the low ends of each of the other ham bands. That's the ham plan. They're split in half. There's a phone side, and there's a digital data, which includes the concept of CW. So you can do CW on the low ends of 10 meters and 20 meters and 15 meters and 17 meters and 40 meters and 80 meters and 160 meters. But I'm glad you're enjoying 30 and keep doing it. Again, that's the whole point of the exercise. I'm kind of going in reverse order, I guess. Your second comment was that... it's modern manufacturing of electronic components. It's they started relatively simple and they've worked their way up. There are computer algorithms and software that allow electrical engineers to design key components in an integrated circuit, and the algorithm will populate the rest of the chip with similar cooperative circuits, and then you send out the die to fabrication facilities, and they make very sophisticated, you know, billion transistor integrated chips. So without modern computer technology, it would be a lot slower. Same thing with electrical engineering. Same thing with building up a printed circuit board. There's places that you can start building. You can output input a schematic, and it will help you arrange the printed circuit board for best position. And nowadays, it's a multi-layered PC boards and plated conductors, and one layer is entirely a ground plane. Sometimes more than one layer. And, if you have nothing better to do someday, go to YouTube and search for manufacturing PC circuit board electronics. And it's incredible. The individual components are supplied on a sprocket like old-time projector film. And it has a device to pick out the components, orient them correctly. It scans it by a camera to make sure that nothing got misplaced, and then it puts it through different technologies, wave solder, where it just kind of dips the whole circuit board in a bath of solder, and then, again, cameras check it, and sometimes hopefully technicians check it as well. So, you know, they've gone very far with this technology, and it's incredible to watch it in action. So you should take a look at it one day. I'm sure there's loads and loads of them on YouTube.
Yeah, no, I know that they blow up things, you know, to the point where when they're designing it, they blow them up on their big computer screens to the point where they look like full-size resistors and capacitors and whatever, and ICs, and that's how they design them and work with them. But the miniaturization is, like you say, Roy, the miniaturization is wondrous, just wondrous, how these machines can be so accurate in soldering these tiny, tiny leads. They're unbelievably small. And how any machine can be that accurate is mind-boggling.
Yeah, well, I mean, the modern technology. I mean, the servos and all the mechanical aspects can be designed to be extremely accurate. So it's certainly doable. And, you know, it's amazing to me as well. It's incredibly annoying if you want to actually repair anything, because depending upon how small they want to build these devices, they can include discrete components that are smaller than a grain of rice. And, you know, that thing kind of pops out off of the circuit board onto the ground, and you're going to spend the rest of your life looking for it. So it can be somewhat infuriating for the guy who wants to tack things back into working order. You know, well-trained technicians with good equipment can pull it off. But they're primarily designed for automated processes where the human beings just observe and check their work.
KF2CC.
Yes, Brian?
Oh, hi, Roy. Just checking in.
Okay, so noted, Brian. Rich?
Yeah, well, I suggest to anybody, download the service manual to your radio, whether it's just a VHF, UHF, or it's also an HF radio. Take a look at the service manual, and you'll just be amazed at the parts list and at the layout of the circuit boards and the block diagrams. You'll just be stunned. I spent like an hour on it last night, and I really got to look at the guts of my radio. You know, I stripped the screw. I was going to take the lid off just to look in it, but I stripped the screw, and I said to myself, that's God's way of telling me to leave the radio alone. Leave the radio alone. I still want to see if I can get that screw out, because I do want to look in it, but that'll have to come a little later. But like I said, that's my higher power saying, leave the radio alone, just use it this time. Don't go into it like you've done with every other radio and television you've ever used before, and computer you've ever used. So, back to you, Roy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you gotta think about things before you do them, because you can't undo them for the most part. And you might want to try getting, you don't have, it's always nice to have a set of extractor tools. They're kind of designed, if you basically kill the head of the screw and there's nothing to grab onto, you put a little drill to make a deeper hole, and then the extractor is designed to get screwed in opposite. Counterclockwise, so it's very useful for stripped screws if the head is stripped, not the threads themselves. Anyway, so you know, like I said, I agree with you. It's amazing, and then on the other end of the spectrum, because there's always the other end of the spectrum, you got these things that are radios on a chip, where they've kind of cut a couple of corners and shrunk it down to a couple of dies, and you got something like the Balfungs. The reason why the Balfungs almost seem like they float, they're so light, is because there's next to no circuitry in there. It's just some radio-on-chip components.
Comment?
Yes, Brian?
Hi, sorry to interrupt. Somebody is having a problem getting the screw out?
Yes, Rich stripped one of his screws on his 7300.
Rich, this is Brian, KF2CC. Good evening. Did you ever think about putting a very thin-bladed object under the screw and try to push it up while you go ahead and use a pair of, let's say, a needle nose pliers to turn it?
Yes, I thought of that, but I didn't want to scratch, you know, while this thing is still in warranty, I don't want to scratch the cabinet. But when this thing is out of warranty, I will try something like this. I don't have to open it. I only want to open it to look at it for 10 minutes. And there are many pictures of it on the internet, tons of pictures of it. So I don't really have to open it. But if I ever, like, you could do the Mars mod where it'll transmit on all frequencies by removing, like, two or three diodes. So I wanted to see those diodes, but I wouldn't have the nerve to even remove a surface mount diode. I'd probably do something to the diode next to it, or the foil of the circuit board, and ruin the whole radio. So for now, I'm going to leave the strip screw where it is and not worry about it too much, even though I've never had a piece of electronics that I didn't open up. Back to Roy.
Is it a cabinet
screw? Okay. Yeah, it's a cabinet screw for an ICOM 7300.
And what was it, stuck? Or did you use the wrong side, the wrong type of screwdriver, because they usually require metric?
You know, I unscrewed all the other screws, and I was shocked when I turned this that it kept on turning, and I thought it was just stuck, but there I looked, I stripped it. But every other screw came out very easily with, I thought, the appropriate size screwdriver.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George, is that screw holding on to anything else, or is it just the cabinet screw?
It's just the cabinet screw.
Somebody wanted to come in, but I feel confident that if you just take a piece of tape, like painter's tape, and slide that under the screw, and then take a very small flat-bladed object, give it some upward pressure, and then using a pair of needle-nose pliers, turning it counterclockwise, you might be successful.
When the time comes, I will try that. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, George, go ahead.
Thank you, Roy. And hello, I've encountered these problems before. If it's a Phillips screw, obtain a slotted screwdriver that is of the exact width of one of the Phillips lines and press on that to go counterclockwise. Do not continue with Phillips screwdrivers. Go with a slotted screwdriver in one of those lines and go with it with a pulsing motion. Not a full wrench, but press down and go with a pulsing motion. You'll get it. Another thing, to go after a surface mount element that you want to lift out of your way, try a number 11 scalpel to just get in there and slice one leg of that element. And you've got to be doing this with a magnified lamp. No question. And you're not holding it on on your shoulder or anything like that. This is a large magnified lamp. Go in there with a number 11 scalpel and slice one end of that surface mount and then tip it upward a little so the contacting doesn't come back. You don't want to remove it completely because one day you may want to put it back. KD2, FIU.
Okay, thanks a lot. George, I just want to point out to people that there's no real such thing as a metric screw head. The metrics are the screws themselves, how long they are, and what the distance between each of the ridges in the screw. There is a difference, though, between Japanese screws and American Phillips screws. Japanese screws look like Phillips screws, but the dimensions are ever so slightly different. And if you do a lot of work with Japanese equipment, it's recommended that you buy yourself a set of Japanese screw drivers that are optimized to work on those screw heads, by the way.
KD2FIU, let me finish.
Roy, they are a metric.
KD2FIU, let me finish.
N1YDY with a comment when he's done.
Yes, George?
I said slot screwdriver. And you go in there and make sure that that slot screwdriver is of the dimension of one of the cross points of the Phillips that you have stripped. Go in there and put pressure down and pulse it. Pulse it. Do not use Phillips. Do not use any crosshead screwdrivers anymore after you have stripped a Phillips screw. You go in with a slotted screwdriver that is of the complete dimension of one of the slots of the Phillips. Pulse it slightly counterclockwise with a pressure downward. That's what I was referring to. Slot.
Yes, that's how I understood you meant it, George. I was just introducing some additional information that for some reason Brian doesn't like. That it's Japanese screwdrivers and screws have a slightly different configuration than American Phillips head screws and screwdrivers. So it's always a good idea if you work on Japanese stuff to get Japanese screwdrivers. Again, they look like Phillips, but dimensionally, they are slightly different. And once again, the head of a screw is not inherently metric because there's no actual, you know, whether it's meters or millimeters or inches or whatever. It's the length of the screws and the thread separation that determine whether it's a metric or an American type of screw. But the ICOM screws are not exactly Phillips. They're very similar to Phillips, but they're dimensionally ever so different.
Okay, I'm just trying to tell him how to back out of his two issues that he cannot challenge. That's the thing here. The two issues that were brought up by W2C that he cannot challenge. I work on a lot of equipment, and this is how I would have approached that and successful. KD2FIU.
Okay. Well, Rich, you know, write it down someplace, and when you feel brave, well, give it a try.
Yeah, no, I've used slotted screwdrivers to do exactly what George is talking about, and it is it's not the only way. You could do what you said, Roy, but the drill bit would have to be so tiny. You know, these screws are very small. The drill bit would have to be so tiny to drill a hole and then get an extractor in there. I think you'd gut out the whole screw. So I would do this. I would go the slottish way. If I had to get in there, I would do the slotted screwdriver way first. I've done that in the past many times successfully.
Okay. Yeah, it depends on what kind of a screw it is. I assume it's a beveled screw, so I don't think you can get anything, quote, underneath it.
Comment.
Yeah, Brian recognized. I just want to hear Rich's response, because I would assume that it's a beveled screw. Ed.
Yeah, it is a beveled screw, and no, I can't get anything underneath it, really. Maybe a razor blade could get underneath it, but that would be about it.
Well, you'd probably mark the heck out of the chassis, and since it's beveled, it would have to go down, and I don't know where it would, how it would get down there. Brian, you want to say something?
Yes. Is it the screw shaft, or is it the screw head that's screwed?
It's the screw head. The screw head is sort of hollowed out. I haven't looked how much it's hollowed out, but I didn't try the slotted screw method yet, but it is, I wanted to leave it alone for now. Like I said, I thought it was a power up on high telling me to leave the radio alone.
If it's a screw that's damaged on top, I agree with the other, I think it was George, who said to use the slotted screw method. Another thing you could also try, and you might laugh at me, but that's okay, is to go ahead and put a hair dryer on it on high for about 15, 20 seconds. And then as it cools, try nudging it a little bit. Sometimes that little bit of give, okay, from the thermal expansion and contraction will let the screw be extracted.
B2FIU.
Yeah, George.
You just might start damaging components in the radio exceeding 130, 140 degrees Fahrenheit because you're putting a hair dryer on metal, and the metal will actually conduct the energy from the heat and exceed the thermal ability of the radio's components. And let me finish with this. Rich, if you ever want to lift a specific component from those type of boards, the number 11 scalpel, and get in there with a magnified lamp, and you just slice very slightly, very, very slightly. 11 is very sharp, and you slice one leg open and turn it up.
Amen.
Wait a second. Okay, I think someone doubled their screw. One at a time, guys.
May I make a comment?
Yes.
What George is saying about the heat, it's not going to be on there for more than just a few seconds. It'll be fine. As for the, and it's only a one-shot thing, the metal will dissipate the heat from the case. Number two, we're not going to go ahead and bake it. The idea is to just warm it to give it that thermal expansion. So even 10 seconds would do right on. It would be fine. The other item with the scalpel is a very good idea. I've done it myself. But you also have to go ahead and watch out for any little bit of, little shavings, micro shavings has to be done under a very, very high power magnifying glass. And that's able to be done pretty easily. I've done that.
Any other comments?
I'd be a little worried about cutting the board. I agree it's easier than a desoldering iron, I think, but I'd be a little leery of cutting the foil.
No, Rich, you will have enough tolerance under a magnified lamp to see the distance of the one leg above the foil of the board.
Albert?
Yes, what do you want to comment about? Well, that was succinct.
Let me ask a question to Rich. Rich, does that screw move at all, or is it just the head is fixed?
It's just the head that's stripped.
Okay. So during manufacturing, they may have perhaps over-torqued it a little bit. Well, I made my suggestions, and, you know, I hope that everything works out for you.
Thank you.
Okay, any further comments on this particular subject?
Thank you, Roy. KS2FIU clear.
You're quite welcome, George. Hank? Was that you, Hank, asking to say something?
Yeah, it was, but it got commented by somebody else, so I don't have anything more.
Oh, okay. Thanks for trying. Any other comments out there before we move on?
Just a statement. I've worked on service mount technologies for many years, and I've ran into all sorts of problems. So I'm just suggesting, you know, what has worked for me, and what I've been taught, and what I've experienced. And, you know, there's no completely right or completely wrong here. But it's not a power from above. You know, you have a stuck screw. And either way, there's a way to go ahead and do it. The only thing that would perhaps bother me is making sure that the case is, you know, untouched, and that has to be handled very carefully.
Yeah, I agree. I like nice, clean equipment. There are some guys who apparently don't. They throw their stuff all over the place, and there are dents and scratches and all kinds of things. But you know, I like my electronic equipment the way I like my books. You can't tell the difference between a book that I've read and a book that I haven't read, because I kind of treat it with tender care.
The only reason to go into that radio would be to do a Mars mod, which is lifting those diodes, and what George says makes a lot of sense. Just lift them on one end. I think there are three diodes you have to lift for a Mars mod, but does anybody know why anybody would want to be on Mars? M-A-R, what's that, the military something with ham radio? I don't even know what it is.
Comment.
Okay, you recognize. It's the military amateur radio service. It's a subset, you know, some amateurs, especially who've been through the military process, they have their own network, they do their own exercises. Up until about 5-10 years ago, there used to be at least two or three services that had a separate Mars. There was, I think, Navy Mars and Air Force Mars and such. And over time, they kind of ran out of budget, and they merged it into a single Mars program. You can apply to be licensed once you have your own amateur radio license, and they do their own things on their own allotted frequencies.
Late check-in.
Anybody on the repeater tonight ever done Mars?
I have, and I've done it on my FT710, which is a very simple modification. All it is on the surface mount, you have to bridge two solder joints. And it might sound easy. It might sound easy, but you have to use a grounded soldering iron, and you have to make a very clean, everything has to be done like super surgical. That's the way it's done. To be honest with you, I would not go ahead and do it because you have to lift up diodes. I just don't think it's worth it for 11 meters.
I don't either.
Yeah, among other things, I find one of the problems with Mars is it's very insular. So if you try and find any kind of details on the subject, you kind of hit a wall that says, first you join us, then we tell you all about us, which, I don't know, doesn't work well with me, but, you know, other people have other ideas. There was someone who wanted to check in. Do you want to check in?
I think the reason why it's called the Mars Mod is because if you're married, your wife will kick you there if you ruin it.
I don't know. Women usually don't care much for electrical equipment. That's why it's always a pleasure to have a woman kind of come on to the technical net. I don't think we've had a female participant in about 9 months or so. It's very rare and in between, so I think that's one of the few things your wife isn't going to give you any syrup over. You know, I mean, if you put a recline, you know, Lazy Boy recliner in your living room, that might get you into trouble.
I meant it kind of humorously, that if your wife knew that you were to buy a new piece of equipment. Check in.
Oh, okay. Yes?
KQ4SYE, Dan, been listening since exit 34 on Interstate 80.
Ah, very good, Dan. I hope you enjoy the technical net. We do this every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
Appreciate it. Currently on the George Washington Bridge on the mobile. We're working the way back to Nassau County. Been listening.
Okay, Dan, very good. I assume you don't have any questions for us tonight.
No questions, but going across the sinkhole took about 15 minutes to get through there. Have to get off the interstate, go up 15, turn around, come back, and keep on trucking. Took about 15 minutes. KQ4SYE.
Okay, Dan, safe trip. Anyway, hopefully we've kind of knocked that around, so now we get to the worst part, the RF ground. Ground, as a concept, is a pain in the backside because it's a very poorly chosen term for a grab bag of completely different things that confuse and annoy people and lead people to kind of just say that ground in general is a myth, which it isn't. Obviously, The electrical code goes on endlessly about AC ground. You could pick up books about audio grounds. You could pick up circuit designs for circuit grounds and chassis grounds. So there's all kinds of different grounds, but unfortunately they don't all describe the same identical thing. Most terms that use the term ground lead to a common point where it's referenced as zero volts potential. When it comes to RF ground, per se, that's not usually what people are talking about. And we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when Rich mentioned the MFJ artificial ground. Obviously, you can't kind of float a ground and have it artificially grounded. What they're alluding to as the term for RF ground is a functionally tuned counterpoise. So in other words, a RF ground that most people would accept as a reality is not the ground rod driven into the ground with the bus bar and everything. It's more the counterpoise or the radial surrounding a ground vertical. located on the surface where the radials act as RF grounds to do a series of things that benefits the efficiency of the antenna. It's not going to block RF burns. It's a different type of ground, which unfortunately we're sort of stuck with. But if you want to keep using RF grounds in the same way that people use circuit grounds and AC grounds, then yeah, you'll end up with it. They don't exist with that definition, but that's not really the proper definition. So the idea that there's no such thing as a ground is a kind of hyperbole in one way and simplification and confusion of confusing terms. That's my best on this. And if you don't believe me, God bless you. Do whatever you want. It's a free country.
Well, what this woman who was giving a presentation at Hamvention, she's the executive vice president of the ARRL and a scientist. And she said, attaching your rig to a ground spike, a ground rod outside, is inviting lightning into your shack. That was her take on the ground rods and bringing them into your shack. And she said they don't help very much at all, if at all. And the thing to do, she said that is important, and so did that article I sent you, Roy, last night. It's important to bond each piece of equipment in your shack to the other piece of equipment, like your antenna tuner and your SWR meter or whatever. It's important to attach those grounds together. And that's as far as I understand it. When she says there's no such thing as an RF ground. Go ahead, Roy.
Again, I don't know if she's doing it for clickbait or what the heck she's doing. RF ground is not related to the ground post. It's simply related to the counterpoises and such. So there is RF ground, but it's a different thing than DC ground or AC ground. And yeah, you should bond the grounds of all your chassis together, so that the voltage kind of floats together on all of them and you don't have ground loops. But again, we keep talking about ground. And you can't have your cake and eat it too. Either and grounds are not a myth, and you're grounding, you're making a common local ground to your chassis, or it's not. So I'm just saying that the title was hyperbolic and, kind of leads to little more than confusion and argument among people, in my humble opinion. I don't think you need a ground rod to ground your particular chassis. I think your antenna system and what you have it mounted on should have might benefit from a lightning ground on the outside. But again, it's a complicated, subtle topic that you can't really cover in 10, 15 minutes, but you can write a terrible title for a talk. And I don't really care if she's queen of the universe and she has 15 PhDs. It's still a degree of hyperbole in that the title says there's no such thing as grounds, they're a myth, but she talks about grounds. So either they're a myth or they're not a myth. And again, you can argue that RF grounds is the way that some people interpret them is nonsense, but there is something that has been used as a term for RF grounds, and that's radials. And if you have a vertical ground antenna, you're going to throw away your radials because ground is a myth? No. You'll use it because it works on the physics of an unbalanced ground installed vertical.
Well, I'm surprised that and very gratified, knock on wood, that I have no RF, discernible RF in the shack with this ICOM 7300. With my Kenwood 440 on 10 meters, I had a lot of RF. I was coming through this, all the speakers I have in my living room, I was coming through them. But so far with this NFED half wave, and the vertical, the 10-meter vertical that I built, there's no RF in the shack, so I'm just lucky, or just today, I bonded the 7300 to the antenna tuner. I attached their grounds together, but I don't see that it really did anything. Nothing changed, and I wasn't having any trouble before. So for some reason, I'm void of RF with this 7300.
Well, I'm glad that's the case. I hope it continues. I mean, as I mentioned before, a lot of people float their ground, which is to say nothing's connected to nothing else. And for sundry reasons, they don't happen to have ground loops, and they don't happen to have RF getting into the chassis too much. And so, bonding them together doesn't seem to do anything particularly helpful, but it doesn't do anything to harm it. So, you know, again, it's like having a belt and wearing suspenders, too. It's not going to cause you any problems. It may be unnecessarily redundant, but it's a good practice to bond your electrical equipment together so that you have far less of a chance of developing a ground loop sometime in the future.
A comment?
Sure.
This is WA2VDH. I remember Dick... Dick Naylor always mentioned that there are three types of ground. There's lightning ground, there's AC ground, and then there's RF ground. Some of them overlap, but for example, the lightning ground should be the shortest, most direct path from your antenna to earth ground, and also reinforced with several prayers, too. Because if it's a direct strike, as was mentioned last week, there's very little that can really save you. AC ground is for protection from potential AC differences due to AC leakage on one chassis. So you want to make sure that your equipment's bonded together so that if you're touching a knob on your transmitter and you're tuning your receiver at the same time, there's no potential difference between the chassis, no AC potential difference. And then RF ground is the lowest impedance path to Earth to allow any RF currents to return to Earth. So those are the three types of ground he mentioned, and as I say, some of them do overlap.
Yeah, but there's also chassis ground and common ground and audio ground. You know, as many kinds of variations of electrical circuits as you can come up with, you can describe it as a particular type of a ground with somewhat slightly different characteristics. Most of the grounds that we tend to talk about are common points for reference to 0 volts. But there are a few, like RF ground, that are variations that lead to a lot of confusion on the part of everyone. And, you know, people talking about you need it, you don't need it, you need it, you don't need it. You know, because I think you'll agree with me that radials coming off of a vertical can be considered an RF grounding system.
It will be considered a counterpoise in that it mirrors... It provides a mirror image of what is happening on one half of the vertical. A vertical antenna is essentially half of a dipole. The other half is mirrored by the ground plane radials, which provide the mirror image of the other half of the dipole. So in that sense, those radials are usually a quarter wave long. Far end is open, so at the connection point, they exhibit very low impedance to RF currents.
Excellent comment.
Wes, we recognize 1 second. But I just want to point out that counterpoises can be called radials. They can be called a whole bunch of different things. So, I mean, and the point is that there's a big difference between the necessary characteristics of a vertical radials in space and based on the ground. There's a reason why, you know, if you took a space-based vertical with, say, three radials, and you planted it straight on the ground, it would be a terrible antenna. You'd probably have to include at least something like 30, sometimes 36 radials in order to do the proper RF grounding and shielding, decoupling from the ground. Otherwise, it would make life much easier. We just would need three radials on a ground vertical, and otherwise it would work. But it doesn't.
But that point where the radials meet and the shield of the cable is connected together, that is a low impedance point. That point is low impedance. So as far as RF is concerned, it sees that as a reference where it can mirror the other half of this dipole, which is really half the dipole, as a vertical antenna. That's why most verticals are quarter waves. But the other half, the other quarter wave, is mirrored by the ground plane radial.
Okay, that's a little special added attraction for radials as opposed to other forms of counterpoises and such. But I mean, ultimately, that point of low impedance, that common point, is again, a lot of times what people describe a ground point as a common point with a zero voltage potential. So, again, I think we're using different terms for the same thing, which is fine. But it can lead to confusion and discussions like this.
Yeah, well, I know. Let me see if I have it. I know that, like, for example, these I've heard of these ground tuners. They're usually used when physically your rig is a long way from Earth ground, and you might have a line going to Earth ground, but because of its length, it has a lot of a series inductive reactants. So if you tune that out, with some capacitive reactants, now you have a very low impedance path to ground for any RF currents. That's what those ground tuners do that you might have seen. But I remember Dick always talked about three types of grounds: the AC ground, the lightning ground, and the RF ground. As was mentioned last week, I don't know which gentleman mentioned it last week, though. In the case of a direct strike, there's very little ground are going to protect you. Really, you have to do a lot of praying in that case.
Yeah, I agree. Again, it's belt and suspenders. It's improving your odds a little bit, but Mother Nature gets the last choice. But I don't think artificial grounds even require you to put it into an Earth ground. It's just a tuned circuit that kind of mimics a tunable counterpoise. At least that's the way I understood it.
So I only got a reading on 40 meters. The rest of the band, the meter didn't even move.
The ground point,
so it was useless on the artificial ground.
Without any reactants that you might have, any inductive reactants, if it's a long piece of braid going to Earth ground, that it tunes out any of that inductive reactants that you would have there. So it's a low impedance path to Earth ground. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is you don't have to connect it to a ground. It's basically a capacitor and inductor, and you're tuning the random length of wire to act as a proper counterpoise, because, you know, not all random pieces of wire are work as well as others as a counterpoise. So that's another discussion that could take years and years of how many radials are necessary for a vertical and what's the length. I mean, some people will tell you it's a quarter of a wavelength. Others will tell you it's shorter than that. Others will tell you should have a random number, especially if you're trying to put up some multi-band vertical. So, I mean, that's a point of discussion for years and years to come. So that was my understanding, that it was primarily just a quick and dirty a tunable counterpoise that doesn't have to be connected to a proper earth ground to somewhat work. And, you know, some people feel that it does something, and other people feel that it was useless and a waste of money. So that's the way with most gadgets these days. Rich, you wanted to say something. You doubled with John, so we'll give you the opportunity to repeat yourself.
I tried my artificial ground with this radio, with this